Hello and welcome to the Mindful World Parenting Summit. I'm your host, Dr. Stacy, and I am thrilled to be joined today by Dr. Mona Delahook. Dr. Mona is a licensed clinical psychologist with more than 30 years of experience caring for children and families. She has dedicated her career to promoting compassionate, relationship-based neurodevelopmental interventions for children with developmental, behavioral, emotional, and learning differences. She is a senior faculty member of the Perfectum Foundation, an organization dedicated to supporting families of neurodiverse children, adolescents, and adults. She is also a frequent speaker, a trainer, and consultant to parents, organizations, schools, and public agencies. She is here today to talk to us about how we can move past simply focusing on behavior and use brain science and compassion to understand and solace children's behavioral challenges. Welcome, Dr. Mona, to the summit.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Tracy. I'm thrilled to be here.
We're so glad you're here too. I mean, there's so much that we've come to learn and understand about the brain over the past, I don't know, it feels like 10 years, there's been a boom. And so I'm really, really thrilled to have this conversation with you. And, you know, let's just jump into it. You know, what does the latest brain science have to teach us about what is actually happening behind the scenes in our children when they're having behavioral challenges?
Oh, it is so exciting. It's really shifted for many of us who are translating brain science into clinical practice, education, parenting. It is so exciting because it's giving us a whole new way to view behaviors as something really positive. No matter if the behavior is challenging that we used to consider a maladaptive behavior or a non-compliant behavior, now we see those behaviors as all of them as being adaptive, A, and providing us information into our child's autonomic nervous system or the children we're working with. So it's a window. Behaviors are a window into the child's nervous system. And wow, what a gift neuroscience has given us for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So we can learn so much. And what we're moving away from, and what I'm proposing, is that we move away from viewing behaviors as good or bad, compliant or non-compliant, and that as we view all behaviors as holding very powerful meaning for what the child needs.
Okay. So no longer just focusing on the surface and just moving past stuff, right? Like when we're focusing on the behavior, we're just getting stuff done, moving on to the next thing, as opposed to really reading our child and really joining with this notion that this child has no intentionality. Like they're trying their best. They're trying their best. And how can we understand what's going on more effectively?
Absolutely. My colleague, Dr. Ross Green, says children do well if they can. So we work on the assumption that a child wants to please us and will do well. A student, our own child, children we're working with, want to please us. And when they can't, there's a reason. And that's what we want to go for. We want to look for the reason.
Okay. Yeah. So you know, we're usually most triggered as parents when the child is like angry, acting out, maybe there's hitting or screaming or yelling, like the big behaviors. And maybe we could go with that. I mean, tell us what's happening when a child is behaving in this way? What is happening inside?
Sure. So I'll start with the larger metaphor that I talk about behaviors in my book, Beyond Behaviors, and that is that we can look at behaviors as the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. So if you know an iceberg has a, you know, like 10 or 15% is above the water, and then that big chunk of ice is below, that's the biggest part. And that's where we want to focus our attention for children. Not on the exact behavior, but for what it means.
Okay.
So here's a general principle based on your question. What do we do for those biggest challenging behaviors? So I presume you're talking about, you know, the ones that parents, that we dread the most: hitting, kicking, spitting, screaming, running away. Those really out of control behaviors are very important signals of something we call autonomic distress. What is autonomic distress? That is a signal that the child's nervous system is choosing that behavior for them as an instinctive response. So our most, what we might consider egregious behaviors as parents are the signal that our child is actually vulnerable and not receptive to us at the moment because their body and their brain, which is basically what our nervous system is how our brain communicates with our body, is telling the child to move. And it's subconscious. So the child is hitting, screaming, doing whatever, because their body state is not compatible with saying, "Mommy, I'm really scared right now," or "Mommy, I'm mad at my brother." If a child can talk it, then they're not going to be hitting, screaming, kicking, running away. But when they can't talk it out, sometimes the stress is so big that the body takes over. And that's when we want to have really the most compassion for our kids and for ourselves as parents. Because as you know, if you're a parent, when you try to punish or reason with your child when they're in those big behaviors, it doesn't really work. And that's because the child's not connected with their thinking brain. So that's, you know, that's kind of a long answer to your question, but those big behaviors are really important signals for parents to pay attention to.
Okay. So what do you, like, basically, I mean, they're already in this, sounds like this fight or flight mode. It's like total survival mode for them. And so how do we bring them back in? How do we, in those moments, how do we respond in a way that's appropriate to their brain state?
Well, okay. So we'll talk about one, we'll talk about how to do that, but also it's really wonderful to learn how to prevent that from happening.
Because of course,
yes. We want to have those times where we actually notice the signals as they're bubbling up in our child's nervous system. That's the magic, because then we can head it off at the pass. But great question. What do we do in the moment? First of all, in the moment, remember that when your child is in what I describe as the red pathway, it's the sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight, as you said, the fight or flight system. I just call it the red pathway because the red is like they've gone red, you know, and we it's for all people, all humans. It's not just children. But when we go red, we can't hear very well. And Dr. Stephen Porges, who is the originator of the what we call the polyvagal theory, which is an understanding of the autonomic nervous system and how it evolved, tells us that the middle ear muscles relax in when a child is in the sympathetic nervous system because their body is poised to move, to run. And you don't really, when you're trying to escape something, you don't listen. So the first thing to know is that when you're when you see your child triggered into this pathway is to stay calm yourself. Because what the child needs is a calm nervous system to co-regulate with them. And what that means is to share our calmness, to share our connection. And oftentimes what I know for myself before I studied all this, when my child did something really bad, my approach was to do something really authoritative back, to say, no, don't do that. That's wrong. And to teach them in the moment. So I want to say that I understand that that's a natural response for parents, but actually neuroscience tells us quite the opposite. And that is, first, stay calm and realize your child is super vulnerable in this moment.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. But certainly I agree with you that getting to the, heading it off first is like what everyone wants to be able to do. So tell us, like, what should we be doing to prevent those big explosions?
Yeah. Well, here's the great news about that. our children's behaviors, what we see in their bodies, the looks on their faces, their gestures, their tone of voice, even how they're holding their body positions, their posture, all give us signs minutes or seconds before the explosion. And this is a great parent hack, because when we learn to read the signals of the child's nervous system, again, through all those different things, I have a checklist on my website and in the book, but it's very long. Yes. But once you go through this checklist, you can figure out if your child is heading towards that fight or flight response. And if they are, then you apply the calming presence tools based on your own child's nervous system right then and there. And oftentimes you can head it off at the pass. Hmm. So what we do is we use the power of observation to calculate how stressed out our child's body and brain is getting.
Okay. Yeah. So we're picking up on, you know, things are not going good. Like they're losing their capacity to just be in their bodies, I guess. And so what do we do then? Like, this is the point, I'm guessing we can talk to them or help them, like, kind of, because their brain has not quite gotten to that red zone.
Right, right. Yes. So if there's still a little window open, we talk. But here's the principle before we talk is that in general, and this is a generalization, but in general for little humans, we go lower and slower. Okay. So we may sit down if they're sitting, or get at their eye level if they're on the floor, and lower our voice. We don't talk as loud. We lower our voice and make it kind of melodic and gentle and accepting. And we go slower. We talk slower because their receptivity is starting to shut down.
Okay.
So you can remember lower and slower. It rhymes. You go lower and slower, and then don't try to confront the child, but try to empathize with the child. So it would be like something like, "Whoa, this is pretty powerful, sweetie. Here, can I sit by you? Can I just be with you for a second? What do you need from me right now? How could we solve this interesting problem?" And so we kind of make it seem like we're on their team rather than we're not on their team.
Okay. So then we can start to get into whatever that problem was, or, and is this, you know, what age are we talking about where we can do this? Are you talking about someone who is a child who's like 5 or 6? You know, I mean, I guess it depends on how, what your child's abilities are.
Yeah, absolutely. It depends on each child's developmental trajectory or profile, because it's not really based on, as you said, chronological age, but on the developmental stage.
Right.
But let me just say that I think we have a misunderstanding across the world about when children develop the ability to consistently control their behaviors and their emotions. And many parents believe that starts at around 2, when children can walk and talk and they look like little big humans, but they're not. So the ability to begin to control your emotions and behaviors consistently starts at around age 3 or 4. And so we need to remember our expectation. We have got to roll back our expectations. Here's another gift from brain science that is unequivocal. The ability to control your emotions happens through your relationship with your parents, and it starts a lot later than we used to think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So age 3 or 4 is when that's really starting to
develop. It's starting to develop, and it continues to develop till the mid-20s. So executive function is finished developing in the 20s. And, you know, that range could be 20 to 28 or 55, as someone told me the other day. I mean, we're always working on this ability. Yes. And that's why our teenagers are vulnerable too, because oftentimes they want to please us, but man, that ability is kind of a little wonky in teenagerhood, and it's all developing. So yeah.
Right. Wow. Like that, I mean, that's remarkable that it's that big of a window of learning. And, you know, it just strikes me that we really haven't done a great job as a society and having this as part of a core education.
Absolutely. We haven't, and we need to. Mm-hmm. 36% of parents in a very huge poll by the 0-3 Foundation in the U.S. Believed that children were able to consistently share things with others and understand others' opinions before age 2. And it's just, you can't share when you're age 2. So you're right. We have to educate the public because, like you said, a lot of this information has only come up in the last 10 to 20 years. And that's not very long in terms of practices, like parenting practice or education. That's actually very short. So
Yeah. No, but at every level in the home and outside the home, we need to get good at this. And so low and slow, is there, you know, also considerations, I guess, I mean, you work with a very diverse population of children and families, some with, you know, different neurodevelopmental profiles. And I'm thinking about the families out there who do have children on the autistic spectrum, for example. And does this still work with children who have that profile?
So glad you asked that. Absolutely. And the importance of looking at individual differences, that is that unique profile for each child, is important for neurotypical children and children with brain wiring differences. So I'm very vocal about the fact that if your child has been diagnosed on the autism spectrum, or if it's suspected that your child, you may have a neurodiverse child, a child with brain wiring differences, many of our practices have not caught up with viewing behaviors as adaptations and compassionately with love. And I have worked with a lot of children who have had their behavior on the autistic spectrum that have had their behaviors timed out, ignored, put on reinforcement schedules. And so I would recommend parents to really go to reputable sources to find out how you can have what we call a neurodevelopmental and relationship-based approach to supporting children on the autism spectrum. Okay. And there's a nonprofit website that I think is super, and it's, we can maybe put it in the show notes, but it's called profectum.org.
Okay.
And profectum means to go forward, and it's profectum.org. It has free resources for parents, and I highly recommend it. It'll help you protect your child against some of those potentially harmful treatments that override a child's nervous system. And we don't want to do that. We want to work with a child's nervous system, not against it.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious to know, I don't even know if they have enough research at this point, but if parents who adopt this way can keep this in mind and really get to the child's level, I guess, and then respond based on a focus on connection, not really attributing too much to what's happening from an intentional standpoint from the child. The child's trying to do their best. What do we see happening in families when they start to put this into practice?
We see a sigh of relief.
Okay.
We feel less blame. Mm-hmm. Parents feel so blamed all the time out in the world. It's such a hard job. Mm-hmm. And we feel relieved. The parents that I work with tell me that they feel relieved. I know that once I shifted my own paradigm as a parent, I felt more compassion for myself and for my children. Mm-hmm. So I have a pretty high standard for my parenting. I was parented in a certain way. And so we tend to redo what happened to us, and with good intentions, of course. Mm-hmm. But when we take brain science into consideration, I found that it leads to more compassion, more happiness, and most of all, more joy, because we're worrying less about those darn behaviors, and mm-hmm. we're realizing that they're useful. They're mm-hmm. not bad. They just give mm-hmm. us information.
Right. So it's the child always is communicating, and we as the adults around them are here to understand, support, and help the child understand themselves, I would assume.
Absolutely. Yeah. And give them the message that that we are connected with them through their difficult emotions and through their happy emotions. Mm-hmm. We're not going to cut off from them when they feel that normal surge of anger, as all humans do. We're going to stay with them through that anger and show them mm-hmm. that, hey, this is a part of being human. Sometimes we get upset. Sometimes we get scared. And so it's exactly what you just said, a very nurturing place to parent from.
Right. Now, one of the things I'm thinking about, because the schools, I mean, everyone, different schools, but generally speaking, when we get, you know, groups of kids together, there's the rules, the behavioral rules. And, yeah. and particularly if children are having a hard time, this is where most of the time, from what I understand, you're going to likely run into this old school behavioral approach. And so I wonder if you have any advice for parents who are using this and maybe seeing some success at home, and how they might engage the classroom or the administrators at the school, so that their child is better understood. Maybe there's a different approach. Do you have any advice around that?
Oh, this is such a present issue for me right now. We have a Facebook post that we're communicating about with parents, and I've gone through 150 comments just wow. yesterday, and it was about behavior charts in schools. So many schools have a behavioral focus because that's how education is taught to teachers. And so these charts in the school, sometimes in the classroom, have a behavior chart, and it shows when a child is doing well, then they get their behavior lowered, or they get, you know, they get put a level down if their behavior gets bad, and they get to go back up if their behavior is good. Mm. Basically, it's, again, I say this with so much respect to teachers, mm-hmm. but parents are talking to me about this every day. It's devastating for sensitive kids. It's very devastating mm-hmm. for kids who can't control their behaviors. And as we just discussed, many kids can't physiologically yet control their behaviors. So mm-hmm. when they get their name on a behavior chart, they feel worse and they blame mm-hmm. themselves. And then the other quiet, sensitive, anxious kids in the classroom go home and tell their mommies and daddies, I don't want to get my name put on that. So they start to worry, even though they're not a behavior problem, mm-hmm. that they're going to get on the chart too. So what we're recommending to parents is, first of all, we have to understand that teachers want to do well for our children. And I always say, I don't blame or shame any of my colleagues. I know we want to do well by children, mm-hmm. but what we can do is provide additional information to teachers about the nervous system. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of blog posts on my website that'll give you examples of what you can say to your teachers mm-hmm. and really network building things that you as a parent can do with your teachers. And then, of course, I have all the research listed in my book, Beyond Behaviors. That's why I wrote it, is for parents to be able to read this and hand it to their teams. If you have a child on an IEP or in special education, or if you just have a child who's you want their daycare center or their teachers to understand mm-hmm. that neuroscience is unequivocal, safe, wonderful, loving relationships builds resilience in human beings. And that's what I'm promoting. And we got to get the word out.
Yeah.
And that's what you guys are doing through this amazing summit.
Absolutely. Yes. And thanks for that book. That's such a great way of kind of saying, this is what's been working for us. Here you go. And it's supportive. to that teacher who's got like how many kids, you know?
Yes. Teachers overwhelmed. They don't have time to really go to all these trainings, but actually there aren't that many trainings out there yet because they're all behavioral. So
right. But it does speak to, you know, what can we innovate? How can we even bring the kids into a different way of understanding themselves? You know, I think there's so much room to go with this in terms of reorganizing, like, what are we teaching exactly in school? And can we integrate this emotional education? Because it's just everything. Mm. Like, if you don't have this, you know, we're not really in a place to learn. Like, our relationship, like, our sense of direction, like, it's everything. And quite honestly, it spends so much of my time as a psychologist with my adult clients teaching them these skills.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
This is where, so our field of psychology has not integrated a neurodevelopmental approach. Mm-hmm. I am in graduate programs all the time, current graduate programs, master's and PhDs in psychology. Neurodevelopment is taught as a, you might take an extra course on it, but it's not the core framework. And my main mission in life is to get this as a core framework because too many psychologists are getting teenagers and adults who don't have, whose parents had no idea that this was possible. And we can prevent a lot of mental health problems, especially anxiety and depression, by how we educate our children and how we educate parents as to how do you nurture a resilient human. Mm-hmm. And in our schools, unfortunately, again, not because of malintention, but many children feel that they are either not good enough or something's wrong with them because they can't control their behaviors. And again, that's why I wrote the book, and that's why I'm traveling. I was traveling every month before COVID, but it's why I'm doing these webinars, is to let parents know and teachers know that the data is out there. Let's translate it. We're in the translational phase. Translational means you take science and you move it into education, psychology, and all that. We're just the beginning of the translational phase.
Amazing. Yeah. Okay. Well, there's lots of room and lots of hope with this. Thank you so much for all the work that you're doing with this already. I know that people watching, or a light bulb may have gone off, and getting your book would likely be really, really helpful. So, you know, Dr. Mona, I have some other questions that we've been asking all of our amazing contributors that I'm curious about your responses to.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're in this pandemic time, and some would say that this is a sign that we're in the midst of a global paradigm shift. Yeah. And I'm curious to know, what is your hope for how humanity might evolve as a result of this pandemic?
I have to make myself look at silver linings because otherwise I'll get really sad. So I do think we are, one paradigm shift we can take out of this is the full and heartfelt realization that our world is interconnected and that we can't have these sort of artificial borders anymore because we are all sick. Our babies, our grandparents, our great-grandparents are all getting this illness. So interconnected is going to hopefully be like the last thing we need to not build walls between our countries, but to join us together. The other piece I'd be remiss without saying is that during this pandemic, we had the murder of George Floyd in our country. And I believe that his death marks the awareness, a new awareness of implicit bias. And that plays out in how healthcare is serving Black communities in throughout our world with the pandemic, as well as the insidious impact of racism and implicit bias. So I believe we are in a paradigm shift, and we're going to learn from it, and we're going to join together. We're going to be more connected in the future than less connected.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, our hope, and I know you share it because of what you're teaching, is that we can actually be, once we're aware, we can actually lean into this compassion and maybe restructure how we do things. The very simple things that we took for granted, really take another look and do it better. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah, thank you. You're right. It's awareness. Yeah. With compassion. It's a beautiful combination.
Yeah. What do you think we're really doing well that makes you feel hopeful about the future?
Well, I think that we are building connections with each other more than ever before. And that is, to me, that's the benefit of social media. I did not have that as, you know, when I was a child and when I was raising my kids even. Mm-hmm. And so I have had so much fun connecting with people through social media and finding kindred spirits and community. So I feel like we're finding each other. Parents are getting support from their living rooms when they're sleep deprived and have, you know, this newborn that's crying, you can always find somebody. So I think that we're finding ways to connect to each other through our online sources. And that's really exciting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I share the same view. And if there was one thing that you would like our viewers to action today that would make a significant difference for themselves and their families, what would that be?
I would say that in a moment when you are struggling, if you could just have a second of self-compassion over and over again, that will be life-changing. So sometimes I just put my hand right here if it's a difficult moment, just like, ouch, and you can do this. Everyone suffers. And I send my kindness to myself. Send kindness to yourself. You deserve it. You're amazing. Parenting is hard. And love always overcomes. So self-love and self-compassion is a fierce parenting tool.
Yes, yes, yes. I love that. The hand on the heart. It's just like so good to have that physical,
grounder.
Grounder.
It does ground us.
It's, you know, it's amazingly simple in a way, isn't it? But sometimes so hard to do. We really need to practice. Absolutely. Okay. Well, Dr. Mona Delahook, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for all that you're doing. You know, power to you getting out there and getting this message out there. Do you want to mention the title of your book again? What's the title of that book again?
Oh, sure. It's Beyond Behaviors.
Yeah.
Using neuroscience and compassion to solve children's behavioral challenges. And
amazing.
Yeah. I look forward to connect with me on, I have a website, monadelahook.com, and at Instagram and Twitter at Mona Delahook, and Facebook, Mona Delahook PhD. And Dr. Stacy, thank you for putting this information out there into the world and all you are doing for us too. So I'm just honored to be your colleague and to be on this journey together.
Thank you so much. I so look forward to following you and sharing that with my clients and everyone here through the Mindful World Parenting Summit. Thank you again for all you're doing to make this a more mindful world.
Likewise. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.